This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumabillet.
And I'm Yannick Ringer.
And from what I heard, tonight we are celebrating something. What are we celebrating tonight?
We're celebrating 6 months of no podcasts about Subway's bread.
Oh my goodness, I'm not starting on that again. Oh my goodness. No, okay, so that was okay, it for so... Limitless.
The Subway bread meme is dead now, officially. We are celebrating my 6 months at my new job, and we're going to talk about that. But first, we have some follow-up.
Oh, yes, we do. I do have a quick follow-up regarding last week's episode for the Apple Pay integration in Canada Part 2. Since the release of the last episode, three other banks that were coming soon are now online. BMO, Scotiabank, and TD now supports Apple Pay officially. Also, like I said, my bank, Tangerine, is mentioning end of July as a final date for the Apple Pay integration. And another big bank called National Bank is also working really, really hard to get Apple Pay working. So it seems to me that the smaller banks and credit union are working their ass off to make sure that they have Apple Pay integration sent to their customer as soon as possible.
Except Desjardins, which...
which is your credit union. Lastly, on mobile payments follow-up, this week's Apple Pay competitor Currency...
Oh, God.
...got finally trashed.
Yay! Woo!
Exactly. So recently they had a round of layoffs, and people started to kind of guess that the end was near. And this week they announced that they won't go through the beta and the testing phase. They just shut off everybody, everything. And they just go back to doing something else.
Well, it sucks for the people who lost their jobs, but that service never really had a reason to exist in the first place, so I'm glad to see it gone.
Exactly, and you can go back into our catalog of episodes to have a better understanding of what Currency was compared to Apple Pay. I think you did a coverage of it during the mobile payments episode.
Yes, which I believe is episode 2.
Yes.
Yeah.
We love mobile payments here at Limbo.
It's basically my favorite episode we've done so far, which is sort of terrible because it means that we haven't topped episode 2.
That's fine. Maybe this week.
I don't know.
But you started with Subway bread, so I don't think it will happen.
I've cursed the episode. Okay. So I have like two small items of follow-up. First of all, I would like to apologize for the sound quality over the past few episodes because, as it's become sort of an open secret amongst podcasters, recent Skype updates have been really ruining the audio quality to really strange effect, because even our capture software is getting bad audio back from Skype instead of good audio directly from the mic, and it's very, very strange, so we're not sure about that. And on top of it all, you're sort of half in the process of moving. I'm half in the process of remodeling, so... we are finding very strange arrangements that are very weird acoustically. I can't speak for you, but I can speak for myself. Right now I'm broadcasting live from the laundry room and running off a battery. So if the audio sounds a little strange over the next few episodes, I mean, it's just because we're in strange conditions right now.
It's either that or start monologuing about your work, which... most of it, I don't know that much, so that would be funny.
Yep, and lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about Persona, because...
ooh.
Yeah, so this week, Persona 5's release date was announced for North America. It is coming out in February of 2017 here. There was a huge kerfuffle about the stupid box art, which I am not going to go into, because it's fucking stupid. But I do want to talk to you about another game, which is sort of very related to Persona, that I sort of forgot about, and I think you might not have even considered talking about, which is Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE, which is coming out this week on the Wii U, and it is basically another Persona game, except with Fire Emblem characters. And the reviews that I've heard from the Japanese version, which came out back in December, are actually pretty fantastic. And I was wondering if you were considering playing that, because I know that one of the things that you mentioned on a previous episode is that Persona is a big time commitment. And on top of that, there's this sort of daily life structure where you have to play through every life of a schoolboy's life or schoolgirl's life. And it's sort of restrictive because there are certain options that shut down to you after a certain date, and you have to finish stuff before a certain date or else that possibility is completely gone. Whereas Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE, according to the reviews, is much, much more open to you doing everything in the game and taking your time. And I was wondering if you had heard anything about it or were interested in it at all.
I won't say I was interested because it is the first time I hear something about this game. And I think I'll have to check. If it's a more flexible Persona game, that could be interesting. Also, do you know if they do something quote-unquote special because it's on the Wii U with the gamepad or something like that? Or it's just typical Wii U game?
I think it's just a mirror screen. I don't think it's a special case at all. But that actually does give you the edge that sort of like Persona on mobile consoles, you can just take it with you around the house. I know it's not fully portable, which is sort of disappointing. And since it's a tie-up with a Nintendo franchise, there is no fucking way this is ever going to be on the PlayStation Vita. But it's still pretty nice, and it looks really, really good. And if I had a Wii U, I would definitely be picking it up because it's sort of like a nice little Persona 4.5 to play while you wait for Persona 5 to come out next year.
Which you were eagerly waiting to remind me that I haven't completed Persona 4.
Have you finished Persona 3? Okay, so you haven't finished Persona 3 and Persona 4.
Yeah. Maybe if I go on a quick and small tangent for it. To be honest, though, I'm sure I would pick back up Persona 4 because I really enjoyed the game and the story, even if I know most of the punchline, if I recall them correctly. The problem I have with Persona 3 is it felt to me that it didn't have any kind of, what would be the best way to put it? I think the progression sentiment in Persona 3 is lacking for me.
Yeah, I think they really tightened that up in Persona 4, whereas Persona 3 sort of, at certain points you're wondering, like, is the next part of the story going to come at some point? And you're just going through the motions and waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I was like, without giving any spoilers, the gist of Persona 3 is you're in a tower and you need to go to the last floor from the bottom, from the ground level. And I was around like level 30, like floor 30, 35, maybe 40, let's say 50 at most. And then I ask you like, oh, I'm really tired. It's like mostly the same thing. It's just like it becomes harder and harder. I'm at level 50 right now. What is the last floor? And then you told me 250, 260. I don't remember the exact number, but it's like a bit below 300 level of floors. And I was just like, okay, I'm done with this game.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly to what degree all of those are required to actually beat the game, because I haven't beaten Persona 3 myself either. I got about halfway through it, and I think I was about on the 70th floor or something of Tartarus. And one of the things that Persona 4 does really well is it's effectively basically the same dungeon structure, except they actually just theme them differently from one to the other, as opposed to just having this one monolithic tower that sort of mostly looks the same throughout the entire game.
Yeah, exactly. I think using the like idea of temples and multiple ones throughout the storyline kind of leverage the progression in the story, and you get the sense that you progress in the game and it's not the same old tower all again.
Yep. So that's it for my follow-up. Now we can delve into this
celebration. Yay. Okay, did I cue that too quick?
No, not really.
Okay, yay!
So this is the third episode in a sort of informal series of episodes every 6 months about my personal status as a developer. It was never planned to be this way, except last summer, or basically about a year ago, we had an episode about my application EOS, which had just shipped. And then about 6 months later, we did an episode about Iconoclasm, which I had just discontinued and I had just started at my current job. And now 6 months later, I'm still here and I am still employed. So that's good, I guess. And I figured it would be good to give a little update on how things are going, because I've gotten a couple questions from friends so it can be sort of like an FAQ on my new job, which is sort of a strange thing to have an FAQ about.
Yeah, and it's also funny because, like, these days, every time we talk to each other and we see each other face to face, it's always making fun of you. Like, I'm just joking, and you know that, but always making fun of you that now you do mostly, like, 99% of your stuff is just web stuff. So you do web programming as a daily basis.
Yeah.
And you're just, like, moving away from iOS, and I'm like, I'm sure at some point you'll miss iOS development, and every time I bitch about something on iOS and you like it and all that stuff, which happened a lot in the past few weeks, you always laugh at me. It's well, like, well, oh, yeah, it's in the web.
It's all stuff that I've run into last year, mostly, for the most part, so I can just, like, relate to you for that. But yeah, I had joked to you a little bit before. I'm not sure if it was on the podcast or off podcast, but before I took the job and before I had even gotten offered the job, I had joked, like, it would be sort of cool to go do some web development for a while and just take a breather from iOS, because I wasn't feeling the platform as much, especially I wrote a blog post this week about my canceled watch app called Concierge, which I had crazy experiences with.
Some of them we told on this podcast.
Yes, yeah. And I just got a little bit burnt out on iOS. I mean, I did it for 5 years. I think it's a pretty good run. I'm not saying I'm never going to go back to iOS, but I think that right now the technologies that excite me are happening more in the browser. And that does not mean I am one of those crazy people wearing the HTML5 shield. Well, I have that shirt, but I mean, literally, like, using it to defend the web and say that it is the true application platform, because I don't believe that for a fucking second. but I think that there's still lots of interesting technology to explore on the web because of how free it is and how much of an open playground it is to experiment with different technologies. And like we mentioned on the Redux episode, where, like, all of these crazy attempts at reinventing programming, most of which are extremely insane, but I like that they're around because they're at least experimental and they give us something to talk about. They're all happening on the web because you don't really have a UI framework to support. You don't have all of these things tying you down to the platform. There, it's just sort of like the Wild West. Do what you want. Whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, you are free to experiment, and it's really exciting for those reasons. And it's I mean, like, some people talk about going to, like, Burning Man or whatever to go experiment and do crazy shit. I went to Burning Web, and
my goodness,
we are going to burn the internet down.
Wow. I'm sure now that you mentioned that, somebody will call a web conference
Burning Web. Yeah. Actually, we were joking today. We were talking about the various amphitheaters in the province and how very little usage they're getting right now. And we were joking, we should start a web conference, and maybe tomorrow I should pitch this idea of Burning Web. It would be really funny. So, yeah.
But maybe before you continue, I think just to go back a sec on the fact that I might be surprised when you told me that, I just remembered a story, like... if I recall correctly, you're right, it was offline. And then he was like, yeah, you remember when we were both in college? Like, I was always, like, toying around with web technologies. And it's always been something that interested you. But you are still so focused on iOS that now you can have the exit way of trying the web. And just going into that world where some people might just try Android development, for example, or just maybe try the Mac development or Windows development.
Well, to be fair, I never really stopped doing web development. Even when I was working on iOS stuff, I had the websites to manage for my products. And yes, they weren't very fancy because I was devoting most of my effort to doing the actual iOS development. But it's always been an interest of mine. And I think that Polyphonic Room was really one of my escape valves for that energy. Polyphonic Room was, first of all, programmed entirely on an iPad in Diet Coda at the time, which is now just Coda for iPad. And it was really trying to make a website entirely mobile first, where even the app itself was made on mobile. and that posting to it and everything would be viable on low bandwidth connections, because when I'm in Japan, usually I'm on basically the equivalent of edge speeds, which is not very good. So I was really optimizing for my use case of mobile first, and Polyphonic Room loaded crazy quickly because it was basically just static page with nothing on it that rendered everything from a JSON file. And that basically hurt us a little bit because we didn't have anything indexed on Google because it was all JavaScript. But I mean, like, that was one of the escape valves where I sort of kept playing around with web technology. But the web has moved so much since the last time I did web stuff seriously that I sort of thought going into the web now would be a good way to catch up to what the current state of the web is right now. And we're going to elaborate on this in a little bit. My job, well, the app that I work on at my job is far from being modern web technology.
Oh, no, and we would kind of want to, I know that you will talk a bit more about like the project you worked on. And
well,
especially
Yeah, I'm sort of limited in what I can talk about for a long list of reasons, one of which is an NDA. Another one is, well, I'm probably not even allowed to talk about the other reason, but...
NDA on top of another NDA, let's just
say. Yeah, financial services business stuff is complicated. I will try to speak more broadly about the job and less about the project specifically. But again, like I've mentioned this on previous episodes, I can talk about the technology stack. I just can't really talk about how we're using it or even about sort of some of the timetable stuff about when we finish certain things, because it's a slippery slope.
Oh yeah, but the point I was driving at was more like the job you have right now is way different from other place or other stuff you could have chose.
Yes.
Because it's more like of a typical enterprise. Like they do, even if they do web application for their own benefit, it's still a big company. It still has this ideology of a typical company where the main focus is not shipping software, shipping a product. It's like the product you guys build are used to make the business live.
Yeah, that's certainly fair.
Sell something.
Yeah.
Which would affect how you develop stuff.
Yeah, definitely. But I would want to qualify that and say that we, until very recently, have been a subsidiary of a much larger company. And this gave us a lot of freedom. And this is going to be a recurring theme. We might not have that freedom in the future. And so we are very quickly trying to take advantage of it while we have it. And I'll go into detail about that in a little bit. One of my two coworkers. So the fun thing is that two of my four coworkers in the IT department on my job were people we went to college with. And another one is the boyfriend of someone who sat in front of me in high school. So that was nice. It was someone I already knew a lot about, but he didn't know anything about me, which is sort of one of those weird async relationships. And one of my coworkers who recommended me for the job was very skeptical about whether or not I would take the job or even enjoy the job, because during college, I love to hate on enterprise software. And I think it's very justified, because most enterprise software is complete garbage. And that is no surprise to anyone who has used enterprise software or software targeting the enterprise, which is not always exactly the same thing. And I want to sort of elaborate a little bit about why this particular job has been, well, I use the word tolerable in my notes, but maybe has been enjoyable for me.
That's not a great way of selling your job out of the open when you say it's tolerable.
Yeah.
When you tolerate it.
But a lot of people thought I wasn't going to tolerate this job, so that's why I use the word tolerable in my notes.
Right. Then you could half count me in those people, but I'm also half joking.
So. Yeah. So first of all, it really helped that I knew two people on the team, because I know that they wouldn't put up with this shit either. So if they're working there, they're probably doing something right. So that's the first thing. When you think enterprise software, you usually imagine an outdated technology stack coupled with maybe a glacial pace of progress requiring approval at every step. And luckily, that is not at all the case at my job. Our boss gives us a tremendous amount of independence. as long as something fits into our budget, we pretty much get freedom to do whatever the hell we want to accomplish our goals. And that is awesome. It's implicit that the trust, it's implicit that they trust us to actually carry out our own feasibility studies for technologies that we want to use and determine whether something or not is, something is a good fit or not for the way we work. And I want to talk a little bit about the way we work, because the development team is three people on the website of things. There's Shannon, Ben, and myself. And we need to be really pragmatic about choosing tools that enable us to do rapid development. But we also have to be very careful, because if we switch technology at every opportunity we can, it'll work against us, because we have to keep switching mindsets. And from time to time, I actually do switch over to one of the internal desktop apps that we work on, because it integrates with our API. And when I'm working on the API, I often have to also write the support in the desktop app. And having jarring changes where you have to change programming language to Visual Basic. I know it's still .NET, but it's still Visual Basic. It's pretty bad. And completely
Visual Basic will always stay Visual Basic.
Yes. And completely different methodologies to working, because our boss, nothing against him, but he's sort of from a different generation from us. And the code very much reflects that. And we want to minimize those kinds of changes. We want our code to be as similar as possible so that we can do rapid development and know what we're doing in every part of the app. Well, of the apps, because we all like seven. We're also incredibly free when it comes to deploying things. Any member on the developer team can and does deploy stuff from the stable branch at any time. There is no need to get anything approved or run any tests when we want to deploy it in production. And I know this bothers you a lot.
It does.
And we actually talked about that today. We might talk a little bit about it later, because something very big broke in a recent deployment, and we don't have tests, so we didn't really notice for like 2 weeks. Whoops. So yeah, implicit in this approach to producing our product, basically, is this trust that we aren't going to fuck up the production build. That happens, obviously, because we don't have tests. We're working on it. But it's very freeing from a developer side of thing. We can be incredibly agile as a team, but not in the agile development sense. Even though I mean, in super big air quotes, we follow agile development. But what I mean by agile is more, we are very responsive to putting out fires and incoming bugs, because there is always some director in another department that is coming to us and saying, I need this report tomorrow. And there's like 3 hours left in the day and you need to get that report out. You have other people who come in and say, yeah, the way that our dealers work, is completely incompatible with the way you made this form, because we never gave you any specs on how to make this form. So please redo it for like next week. And that is also very panic mode stuff. But because we have so much freedom and we choose our tools very, very precisely so that we know them very well, we can operate at a much, much, much more, much quicker pace than any of the other subsidiaries of the company we work for. And we were recently reviewed because we got acquired basically by our parent company. And what takes them years takes us months. Of course, they probably have tests. They probably have a bunch of other stuff. But at the end of the day, what we do more or less works most of the time. And we get the job done much quicker and on a much smaller budget. And at the end of the day, you have like, what is theoretical correctness and what is practical correctness? And you sort of have to always balance those things. But I think that it's not necessarily a bad idea to optimize for developer happiness. You want to eliminate the bottlenecks of getting stuff shipped to your users, because ultimately that's sort of what you want to do. You want to ship products. And I've never shipped as much code as I have in the last 6 months. I can guarantee that I haven't written that much code. And like, I've probably written more code in the last 6 months than I have in the last 5 years. And of course, the challenges are completely different. I mean, like with jailbreaking stuff, you are testing a lot of hypotheses on this black box that is Springboard and trying to get shit to work, and you throw out a lot of code because some of the time it doesn't work. Here, we write a lot of code, and most of it goes out to users very quickly. Of course, I was hired to help on a specific project, and our specific project is sort of half shipped to certain people. So I can't really speak to how often we ship that product, but for the other products, I mean, I've been patching other products up as we've been winding down development on the other project. And I mean, we get stuff out there pretty quickly. We have basically a couple deployments a week, and that's pretty nice. It's a much faster feedback loop than the App Store, to say the least, or even Cydia to that point. And I think it's really, really precious to let your developers have some kind of input on the technology decisions, because they know what's going to be most pragmatic for the way that they work. And we are seeing right now what happens when you leave it up to enterprise salespeople, and I do not like the results. And I'm not alone in not liking the results of that. I think that enterprise salespeople are really, really good at making their products look attractive to the people who make the buying decisions. But when it comes to the developers, nobody wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole. And that is not good if you want your developers to actually get work done. Do you have any input up until now?
Not so much, to be honest. That's why I'm pretty silent. I do have a couple of questions in mind, but they were more like general, so I will maybe keep them a little bit later.
Well, general stuff is good to go now, because I'm going to get more into the technology fun stuff next.
Oh, okay. So maybe I have two softball questions here. And what would, and I'm sure the first one will touch more on the technological side, but what would have been the easiest thing or easiest like challenge, or I don't know, you'll define it, but the easiest X you've done in the last 6 months, since it's like, to be honest, so you move from doing your own products on your own schedule to being enforced a schedule, enforced kind of a, not a vision, but yes, a vision. Like, you need to work into the company's vision and all of that stuff. So the first one would be, what's the easiest thing you've faced? And what would be the hardest thing you faced regarding that change?
I think that I might bend your question a little bit. I think that...
Well, feel free to do so.
I think that one of the things I wasn't expecting that actually ended up happening pretty quickly is I am just naturally way more productive in an office environment where I feel that people can watch me and they can see me slacking off. Whereas when I was working at home, that was not really something that happened. And I could slack off as much as I want. And that's not to say that I don't go on Twitter and reply to your instant messages and all that stuff at work. I mostly tend to do it while code is compiling, though, and code compiles a lot. But I think that's one of the big reasons that I've gotten so much done over the last 6 months compared to other times, is when you're working for yourself, there's no one really to enforce policy, and I am a very submissive person, and I tend to just get into a little ball if I have confrontation. So to avoid confrontation, I will work my ass off. And I think that that is an advantage where I am incredibly productive. And in fact, like, some people are even upset at how productive I am, because it makes them look bad. I think I, you know, that. Who I'm talking about.
I heard that.
But... yeah, I try to be extremely productive, and I wasn't expecting to be that much more productive, but I am that much more productive, and it's scary. It makes me realize how little I've actually done in the past 5 years, which I don't want to admit to myself, but I guess it's really true.
Sure, but still, regarding that point, would you say that it's because you're in enterprise environment, or more that's just because you need to go to a place and this is work stuff, and then you do work and at some point you go back home and it's now home stuff or personal stuff?
It's sort of tricky, because I think if I had had a separate office that I could go to just to work on my iOS stuff, nothing would have been really different. I think it's really just there is an authority figure who is counting on you to do stuff, and I don't want to let them down. And at the same time, I don't want to be confronted because I'm slacking off or whatever, so I'm just going to work as hard as I can. And I mean, so far it's worked pretty well. I'm not working myself to death. Like, I'm not going to burn out. At least I don't think so. Because I still manage myself pretty well to not overwork myself. But it just makes me realize how much more I could have gotten done if I had been more disciplined as a self-employed person. On the opposite end, you were saying the hardest thing.
And when I say the hardest, maybe the most, I know it becomes the same, but the most difficult or the kind of something you maybe not guess that would happen, or like something that took you as a surprise.
Honestly, I thought that the project was going to have specs. And I hate bringing up this point, but we basically have had to... I came into the job knowing absolutely nothing about insurance at all. And now I have pretty good grasp on at least two types of insurance of the three that I've had to develop throughout the project. But I've had to mostly guess this stuff from either database tables that were already there when I got there, or just asking tons of questions to my boss. But there is no Bible with all of the insurance rules in it. And that just sort of pisses me off, because you have this really, really important business. Well, okay, I'm sort of exaggerating a little bit, but you have this business that has very strict requirements on, we need to be within X percent of this range of error. Otherwise, we are not going to make enough money. And you have people who their entire job is to verify that the insurance prices that come out of our product are correct, but there is no document you can point me to that actually tells you how those prices are calculated. There is code that tells you how to do it. No fucking clue if it's actually working correctly. It's just, we pull stuff out of our asses and we correct it as people tell us it's wrong. And that is not the way I expected financial services software to be developed. I think it may be particular to our business. I don't want to blame anyone, because honestly, I don't think anyone is doing it intentionally. I think they just think that we know everything about the business and they don't realize that we need more guidance to actually get stuff done. Luckily, my boss has worked basically almost every level of the food chain, as far as I can tell, except for like the big boss. So he knows a lot about how the business works, but even he doesn't know all of the algorithms and everything we need to implement to get stuff done. And you sort of have to improvise. And that worries me, because what if your improvisation makes it all the way into production and it's wrong? I would feel very bad if my code ended up being wrong in production. And luckily, we are only in production to like three people right now, so it's not too bad. But when the project launches for real, like right before I left work today, I had to do a big deployment with regards to user rights. And basically, I know that at the time I deployed, not very many people were logging in or were going to pay attention to their login screen, because everybody leaves it around 4 and I finished around 3:50. So I can pretty much guarantee that no one actually ran my code other than myself. If tomorrow morning I get to work and the tech support guy's phone is off the hook because they suddenly don't see apps that were there yesterday, I'm going to feel like garbage. And
and now you're dead.
And now I'm dead. So my bench fell off. I'm going to try to... There is just like one less leg on the thing I was sitting on. That's nice.
Yeah, like we mentioned at the top of the show, we are improvising a bit in our place we record. And while Yannick is trying to catch up his bench parts that are running all over the laundry room, hopefully... he will survive.
Yeah, I'm not dead.
Okay, he's not dead. Good.
Okay, I should be able to sit again. I hope it doesn't fall.
Oh my goodness. To be honest, though, I think that's one of the best, like, weird moment of our podcast.
This is almost as good as the police officer in Yokohama.
Oh, yeah.
God, I'm going to fall down again. This is guaranteed to fall down.
Now that you mentioned this moment back, I'm not sure if...
That was really strange.
Oh, I think that's our top number one.
Yeah, this might be number two when I fall off the bench and almost die on air. To be honest, I was more worried about my laptop falling down than anything else. Okay, where was I? Yeah. So, yeah, in theory, tomorrow the phone could be ringing and ringing and ringing because people's apps have disappeared.
Or because you fall off your bench or something like that.
No, I don't think people are going to be calling for that. And that would be, I mean, like, I'm a little bit anxious about it. I know that it shouldn't. And I've looked at the database table after running the migration and everything looks good. But there's always that part of you that thinks, did I just fuck something up badly in production? And that makes me worry. And again, this is why you have tests. Asterisk, we don't have tests.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Now, this tells me that my big random test over the weekend was successful.
It worked because it worked. I think we quoted it a couple times today.
Oh, really?
Maybe not today, yesterday.
But let me just give you an example. So just to bring everybody to the same level, I met with Yannick and Shannon over the weekend because I was in our own town for the weekend. And then the guy started to work about to talk about work because I was asking questions like, how's work, blah, blah, blah. Typical, like, asking question about work stuff. And then they started to talk about new technologies that I'm sure Yannick will mention in a bit.
Yes, sir.
And also started to talk about the fuck-ups they did in the past, which was always funny to have a discussion with tech people that does code. And then I was like, do you have tests to make sure that never happens? And then cricket. And then I kind of started on a rant about tests.
Yeah.
Which is a big problem, though, because I'll repeat it again, and I said it a lot over the weekend. Right now in my current job, we have a big culture around unit testing. It's part of our workflow. It's something I do daily. And I would say that half of the code that I write these days is unit tests. Because it's the way we design, we start the project. It's the culture we have between all of the developers in our team. And personally, I got saved by unit tests a couple of times. And every time you just remember this last time you said, oh my, I still need to write unit tests. What if I could skip them and just ship now?
Yeah, definitely. I think I actually got more insight into why there weren't tests from the start in other projects from our fuck up this week that made us realize that basically our app hadn't been working for 2 weeks. And I think the thing is, the project that I got hired for is the first one to be really transactional, where you are doing lots of input and saving of stuff, whereas the other ones are much more read-only. They're not all read-only, but they're mostly read-only. And so the chances of stuff fucking up are much higher when you're actually modifying data in the database than when you're not. And yeah, you can still change the change the information that's displayed to the user in ways that are invalid, and I'm fully understanding that. But I think that there's so much more stuff you can fuck up if you are doing transactional apps, and the one we're working on is like 17 times more transactional than everything else in our app. And there is so much more ground to cover with regards to stuff to test when you make a change. And even stuff like stuff you would never think would actually impact other code does. And that's scary. And we really had a big scare this week. And we are reprioritizing, let's say, the importance of getting tests in there significantly. And hopefully this will amount to something. Right now I'm putting out fires. In a couple days, maybe, we're going to start looking more seriously at integrating, finding a way to adapt our code so it's more easily testable, because right now it just isn't. But we're looking forward to that. We're also looking forward to a bunch of shiny new toys and technologies, which we will talk about right now.
And by the way, all of this unit test and discussion might bring us later on, not this week, but later on a testing pod episode.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, I have a couple of ideas, but still, like, every time you mention that I should do a Swift episode, I still have so much, like, not brittle, but just, like, blobs of ideas about the general topic that it's, that is either Swift or unit testing and testing as a whole as developers, that I think maybe if you guys, especially you at work, start to do that, maybe it will help us, help me put the blocks at the right place, and you will be able to just bring on more value to this. But it's something on my mind for a while, though.
Yep, that would be pretty interesting. So yeah, we've been playing around with new technologies. So I've mentioned it a little bit that we got sort of absorbed by our parent company. I'm not sure how business stuff works. So I know we were a subsidiary before, and now we are just fully merged into the big company. I don't know if that makes any sense as a description, but let's just roll with it. I haven't really been paying attention because I'm technically not an employee. I'm still a consultant. So corporate structure really doesn't interest me that much. And one of the big looming threats in our peaceful developer lives is this threat that we may actually have to start following corporate policies for development. And this means basically all of the freedom that I elaborated on how awesome it is would disappear. And we are fearing this future pretty much because we are not necessarily in agreement with their technology choices or any of their technology choices. And we don't want to get into a crazy state where we have our productivity cut in half or in a third or whatever because of this big looming corporate entity that enforces us to do stuff that doesn't really benefit the actual end product. And so we are taking advantage of our remaining freedom while we have not fully been assimilated into the parent company to get as much cool shit into our project as possible so that they can't actually ask us to not do it because it's already a part of our projects. This is how you get shit done, kids. And so, we talked on the last episode, that, Shannon and I worked on a hackathon project in Angular 2. And one of the things we really liked working on this Angular 2 project was TypeScript. And I am a big proponent of TypeScript now. TypeScript is a type annotated version of JavaScript. Facebook has a similar thing. I believe it's called Flow. I don't remember. They have so many F names for their products that I am not too sure which is the right one. But Flow sounds right.
Are you sure they don't have like multiple versions of the same concept? Because that would be typical of Facebook.
Not for that one.
It's surprising.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, so TypeScript is by Microsoft, which is surprising because you don't really think of Microsoft when you think of cool things. But Microsoft has changed. And one of the really great things about Microsoft's developer stack, as we've sort of mentioned on previous episodes, is Visual Studio. Visual Studio, it is not perfect. Xcode is not perfect either. Xcode is sort of a pile of shit. But Visual Studio is a little bit better, but not perfect. There's still times where the entire app freezes up because it's trying to render a really long line. But yeah, so the tooling that Microsoft delivers for developers is fantastic and basically unparalleled. The autocomplete is perfect. And you can get a taste of it, even if you're on OS X, if you go download Visual Studio Code. Oh, sorry, it's not OS X anymore. It's Mac, lowercase m, OS.
Hey, don't go too fast on those news.
Okay. So autocomplete and all that stuff is really, really great. The type system in TypeScript, we spent the weekend explaining it to you. And you were basically amazed at all the crazy shit that TypeScript could do. And that is basically the reaction of everyone who actually looks at TypeScript's type system. Like, I have never seen a type system that does what the developer expects it to do as often as TypeScript does. It is probably, I don't want to jinx it, but it's probably my favorite TypeScript system in any language right now, which is very high praise, I would say.
Oh, it is. Especially if you say that it's your favorite one.
Yeah. And
because you're picky. You're really, really picky.
Yeah. And I don't like JavaScript, that much. I mean, I like what you can do with JavaScript because it's what you use in the browser, right? I think that playing around with the DOM and even something like Sarik's script on iPhone, which is Objective-C bridging built into JavaScript for jailbreak users. Well, you don't necessarily need to be jailbroken, but you can basically do crazy jailbreak stuff with Sarik's script. And I think it's fun to have a little dynamic language that you don't have to worry about typing and just fuck around and have fun in the web environment or on a jailbroken iPhone. But when you're building large-scale applications, non-type stuff really starts to fall apart. I'm sorry, hashtag dynamism in Swift, people.
No. Come on. We said that the Subway bread was enough. Can I rage quit this podcast now?
No, you can't. Okay, now that I've gotten all the memes out of the way. Yeah, so we've just had a lot of trouble with trying to get JavaScript to work in large-scale applications, and I think everybody struggles. And TypeScript has really made it simpler because we can rely on tooling to correct the dumb mistakes for us instead of waiting for it to happen at runtime. And I think that this is something that many statically typed languages are trying to do, and I think that it is a valid point and that we should listen to it, and I should stop making this point because nobody cares. Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Watch out. I'm sure I'm behind your back trying to knock you off your bench or something.
I'm really scared of sitting on this bench now. So yeah, TypeScript. We basically did a feasibility study where we started integrating it and replacing certain pages of our application with TypeScript implementations of our JavaScript pages. And we really, really like it. We are sort of failing with regards to JavaScript best practices right now. So all of our, well, not all, but a lot of our code is literally inside a script tag inside the page, which is probably the worst practice imaginable. But that is how the team was used to developing before I showed up. So, you know, you stick to the structure of the project. I don't want to impose my structure on other people and pretend I know better than them, although I mean, I knew it wasn't a really good idea when I saw it.
Oh my. Don't be that type of consultant, please.
Yes. Yeah. But we really like TypeScript. It's helped us a lot. Slowly, we are going through, well, not right now, but very soon, as we go through and fix bugs throughout the system, we're going to be redoing pages in TypeScript as we go along, so we can slowly migrate to having more and more typed stuff and more stuff with warnings and errors instead of just random runtime crashes, which is great. It was sort of a crazy ordeal to try to get it integrated into Visual Studio, and you had the chance of listening to our 45-minute to 2-hour speech about how we did it over the weekend. It was a little bit complex, I think.
Oh, yeah. I'm still surprised that it worked, to be honest.
Honestly, modern JavaScript is sort of a crazy clusterfuck of shit. And it changes all the goddamn time. So we did our hackathon project like a month ago. Not even. It was basically on May 14th. It's currently May the 8th. June 8th, sorry. Yes. And since we did our Angular 2 project, one of the big Angular 2 dependencies completely was replaced with another dependency. We found this out like last week, earlier this week when I started building an Angular 2 project, which we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about a little later. So stuff moves really fast in the JavaScript world, and this is sort of a big recurring problem of the JavaScript world, is everything is constantly moving forward and very little documentation is done because everything is moving very quickly. So you sort of have to figure shit out by yourself a lot. And one of these things I would like to point out is ECMAScript 6 modules. Does anyone really understand how ECMAScript 6 modules really work? I don't think so, because there's no documentation on them anywhere, and every module loader does stuff differently. and nothing fucking works. It's really bad. Because so much is left up to the implementation of the module loader, you cannot rely on any documentation at all to be reliable. And stuff that works in development might not actually work in production because you might be using two completely different methods to actually bundle your JavaScript up depending on how you're working. And it's sort of a crapshoot and nobody knows how shit works. And luckily there are frameworks like React or Angular 2 to basically try to force you into a certain structure so you don't get fucked over by stupid bullshit like the ECMAScript 6 modules not working. But yeah, TypeScript is great, don't get me wrong, but JavaScript is still poison. It just tries to make poison more tasty.
And regarding a comment about all of those dependencies, it seems to me that these days dependencies in the web are either short-lived or too long-lived, if you see what I mean.
Well,
there's no kind of middle ground where people, like you have the early adopters that use them, then people start to use them for a year, and then something new grows out of the current problem of this solution.
Yeah.
And then you have this kind of somewhat slow, fast cycle.
Yeah, I think basically the most reliable dependency in the whole chain is NPM, and nobody fucking wants to install NPM. Like, literally, it is. I sighed so strongly when we had to install Node in our project, because I think that Node is sort of emblematic of everything that is wrong in modern JavaScript culture, and I should probably do a full episode on this. But back in my day, God, I'm fucking...
Oh my goodness.
Back in my day, you made a script tag and you typed scripts into your script tag, and that is how JavaScript ran. And I know I just said it was a bad practice, and it is a bad practice if you're doing a large-scale application. But the gist of the thing is, you can type shit into a file that ends in .js, you can put the URL to the .js file in the script tag, and your application is scripted and everything works. In 2016, most of the JavaScript libraries you are depending on are written in ECMAScript 6. They are assuming that you are going to have NPM and Node installed, and they are probably going to use ECMAScript 6 modules, so get fucked, you sort of have to understand how the module system works. And all of these assumptions basically mean that you are the edge case if you're the one trying to use the script tags in a page. And you are going to get screwed over so bad. But there is no page on the internet that tells you, okay, hello person who is developing with script tags, here is how you catch up to the reality of 2016 JavaScript. Nobody has written that fucking page because probably nobody understands how the module system works, so they can't write the fucking page because they don't know how it works. And even I couldn't write a page about how it works because I don't even know how it works. And it's sort of this giant fucking mess. And I fucking hate NPM and that we have to rely on it for everything now, basically. And I'm not sure where I'm going with this. I'm just really angry that we have to have Node in our project. Even though we aren't deploying on Node website. That's the dumb thing, right? We're deploying to an ASP.NET server that doesn't know anything about the Node environment, except we still need Node on a machine to install these fucking JavaScript packages that are written in JavaScript to execute them on the dev server. It's really dumb. I hate it. I think people... How do I say this? Like, we were talking about... shell scripting at work this week because I am a big proponent of using shell scripts to do a bunch of shit. And when my coworkers complained, of course, that I was writing in a shitty language. And then I was like, well, I could write my scripts in Ruby, but would you really want to install Ruby to run my script? And he said, no, of course not. And then I said, yeah, well, that's how I feel about JavaScript. We have all of these people writing tools for development that inherently don't need to be in JavaScript, except because they involve JavaScript, they decided to write them in JavaScript, and now everybody fucking needs to run Node on their machine. And that is sort of the problem we had. Instead of having the self-control of saying, I don't want people to install this stupid programming language just to run my thing, they said, no, everybody's going to install this stupid programming language to deal with this thing and deal with it. And that is modern JavaScript development, and it pisses me off. So I'm glad we got that rant in there, because of course it wouldn't be a Limitless Possibility episode without me complaining about bullshit.
Oh my goodness. But I was about to say that this could have been another topic on our list where we rant about package managers.
Yeah, well, yeah. I had originally planned for that to be a separate episode, but I sort of jammed it all in there. So bonus episode.
Yeah, but we haven't talked about CocoaPods, which I have a lot to
say. Oh, this is true. I also hate CocoaPods, but we are not going to talk about it on this episode. But maybe we should do a CocoaPods episode. It would be funny, and we can talk about Carthage.
Oh, we could.
We could. Okay, but I should probably move on because I have a bunch of other stuff to talk about. But yeah, we integrated TypeScript into our project. It took 2 weeks. We did a feasibility study. Now it's running in production, and nothing involving TypeScript has broken. Other stuff is broken, but nothing that was caused by the move to TypeScript. That is good.
Nothing is as broken yet.
Yeah, maybe it broke. We just don't have tests. Okay. We have been breaking so much shit this week at work. But none of it seems to have involved TypeScript. It's all other stuff. Moving on to another cool technology. Let's talk about Angular 2. So this week, before I started fucking shit up badly, we started integrating Angular 2 into our projects because we had a little bit of spare time and we are discontinuing one of our apps. So why not? I sort of suggested this as a joke and then everybody approved it. So I guess it's not a joke anymore. I said, well, maybe we should put up a warning that the app is discontinued and maybe I should do it in Angular 2 just so we can get Angular 2 in our project. And then they can't tell us to get rid of Angular 2 because it's in production. And then everybody approved it. So I guess I'm doing Angular 2 on production now. So yeah.
Yeah, your joke backfired on you.
It's not really backfiring because I'm very happy that we are starting to integrate Angular 2, because Angular 2 has a lot of good best practices in there, which encourage testing and all of that stuff. So if we can actually integrate that framework into some of our other products, it would be much, much easier to unit test our applications than it is right now with the giant script tag on every page.
Then let me correct what I said. It positively backfired on you.
Yeah, well, there's the other problem, which is that Visual Studio's TypeScript support has a bug in it, which actually prevents Angular 2 from working correctly right now, but it works in Visual Studio code.
Oh, no, really? And
now I have to figure out like what I have to fix in Visual Studio to actually get it to work. But then a bunch of stuff exploded, so I had to change tasks. But yeah, so we're doing Angular 2. Angular 2, it's really cool. You should check it out. I am personally more attracted to React. I've mentioned React a bunch of times on previous episodes. I think it's really neat. I'm not necessarily convinced that it is the best approach for web development right now, but it is certainly an interesting one. And Angular 2 is basically saying, okay, we took Angular 1 and we took some input from React, which is gaining in popularity, and we sort of mushed the two together. And the output basically is you get something that is more flexible and less opinionated than React is. And I think that is good for certain types of applications. There's also stuff like dependency injection is basically like the default for everything, which means it's a lot easier to test shit. Whereas I am not too sure what the story is with regards to that on React. So there's a lot of interesting stuff to do. We are very drawn to the idea of having more modular components because right now, as I said, we have a giant fucking script tag. So that is sort of a blob, and there are not really modules or separation of concerns at all in our web applications right now, and we want to get better at that. The problem, of course, as you've probably realized, is I've thrown out basically like three things we want to do. We want to do unit testing. We want to do TypeScript, we want to do Angular, and we sort of have to pick our battles right now. It was cool when we were just going to do TypeScript and Angular 2, and then everything broke, and then we said, yeah, maybe we should reconsider that testing thing, and I think that's a good idea. But the problem is we only have a set amount of time, and we need to basically choose what we're going to devote our attention to right now. And as much as I would love to integrate Angular 2 in our stuff, the project I was using it on, as I said again, is discontinued. I was using it mostly to learn how Angular 2 works to do specific things in our applications. For example, nobody can give you really a good answer as to how you manage user rights in single page app frameworks. I mean, there are ways to do it, but none of them are really good answers. And we wanted to learn, how do you do good rights management with Angular? How do you do like good translations? Right now, Angular 2 is in release candidate. There is no canonical answer as to how you get localization working in Angular. And that's a problem because we have applications in French and English right now. We currently have three applications that are bilingual, and I assume that there are going to be more than that in the future. So there are all of these problems that need solving on the Angular side before we can really actually implement it in our applications. And then on the other side, there's this continuing thing, which is every time someone's modifying code, we are at risk of making shit blow up in production, and we have no way of verifying that we haven't, other than manually going through and testing everything. So we really want to get tests, at least on the server side, working. And who's going to be doing all of this? Well, right now, I'm assigned to both the Angular 2 task and the testing task. So I guess it comes down to my choice which one gets priority. And right now, honestly, I'm feeling that I should probably go for the test one.
Interesting.
So yeah, that's sort of what's going on nowadays. That's sort of like this week in what's happening at work, is sort of this toss up of what do we do? What do we devote our time towards? What is going to be? Because the other thing is, starting next week, everyone is going to be basically alternating that they're going on vacation. So developer resources are going to be down because people are going to be out of the office. And that means that the team is going to be basically half the size. So while there are fires going on in our applications, there's also going to be probably me doing some sort of R&D or something, either trying to get our code to be more testable or trying to get Angular 2 in there. And as I said, I'm really leaning towards the test thing because, I mean, Angular 2 is a nice to have thing. And yes, it would facilitate client side testing, but ultimately I think that the server side testing is more important because we need to validate the correctness of our application more than we need to validate the UI is working, I think, which is sort of a hard choice to make because as someone who's been dabbling in iOS, well, not dabbling because I've spent 5 years of my life doing iOS development, but as someone who's been doing iOS for 5 years, you could argue that user interface testing is maybe what's most important. I watched a speech by Ellen Shapiro, I think her name is, this week from UIConf, which is a interface conference that was in Germany for iOS on testing.
And by the way,
their
playlist selection seems awesome.
Their playlist selection?
Their movie, like their video selection. Oh my goodness, I was thinking of the playlist and the video at the same time.
Oh, okay. So I watched that talk and she argued that, well, what's most important is testing the UI because that's what your users interact with. And I get that. But the thing is, like, if our client side validations work, but our server side ones don't, I still don't think that's a good success. Whereas if our client side validations fail, the server side validations are still going to be the fallback before stuff that is erroneous gets saved into our database. And so, for that reason, I'm sort of leaning more towards server-side testing for now and later introduce UI testing. I still have a lot of decisions to make about that, and I still have to talk to my other teammates because, of course, their input is important as well. But that's sort of what I'm trying to figure out all while putting out fires because we got a batch of user tests. User tests are cool when you can get people to do them. Luckily, we sort of got a really smart person at the office to do some user tests on a part of the app that I am more or less 100% responsible for. So that's fun. I have to go fix all of those bugs. And I mean, I don't mean this ironically. It's actually really, really nice to have someone who finds bugs for you. If only we had a QA department.
QA department are awesome.
Yeah, but we don't have the scale for that yet. So yeah, I have to go put out those fires and then I have to figure out like what are we doing about testing, or what are we doing about Angular, and which is more important. And then I have to actually do it, because that's not going to be easy either. Our code is not structured for tests at all. And we not only have to get our current code adapted to be more testable, but I also have to sort of write the laws on how we do the best practices for our code to be more testable. Because if we just test our existing functionality and then continue to write our code in the same crazy way we are right now, that's not going to be testable. And then we have the same problem 2 years from now if we still have a job. So that is where I'm at with work. I didn't mean to drag this on so long, but that's sort of what's going on.
Good. So you know what? Hopefully you'll be able to stay there for a while. I think you explained quite a lot of the challenges and the fun parts of your work, and that's pretty neat. And hopefully in a year from now or 6 months from now, we'll be able to talk about it again.
Yep, and hopefully this bench that I'm sitting on could have some tests written for it so that it doesn't break while I'm sitting on it.
That would be nice, but still.
But I hope that you can probably hear from my tone that I'm very excited about this work, and I haven't been this excited about stuff in a really long time. And the challenges are interesting, even though it's really scary to break things in production.
Oh, yeah, I think that's kind of the gist of this whole episode is you were unsure like six months ago when you were tackling this new challenge of moving to web development. And now it seems that this idea and challenge has paid off and paid off the big bucks. Not only, like, I'm not speaking about money here, I'm just speaking about your own happiness and also just the fun of doing new shiny things and working on different problems.
Yep.
Good. So if you want to catch up this show and all of our other shows, you can go on our website at limitlesspossibility.net. You can also find the podcast on Twitter at @limipo_podcast. That's @LIMIPO_podcast. I'm also currently forgetting about our other episode and the our show notes that can be found for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/42. I'm also on Twitter at @lucconouche. That's LUCCONOUCHE. And then it can be found at
Sakurina, SAKURINA.
See you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks on Google Play Podcasts.
Oh my. Oh, why are you dropping that at the end?
Because I don't want you to forget.
I know, but you know what? Maybe before you go, maybe we won't be on the Google Play Podcast.
Oh dun, dun, my dun. God. Wow.